So again, thanks for having me. So today I'm going to talk about a collection of works that we might consider to be, we might call it the study of the science of quantum gate sets. So when we build quantum computers, we're going to, our goal is to be able to transform some sort of a computational subspace of some physical system by applying some sequence of elementary operations in order to have the computer do something useful for us. So in this talk, I'm going to try to kind of describe a vision towards this goal that utilizes some pretty interesting methods and techniques from algebraic number theory and what you might call non-commutative number theory. So just to start, make sure that we're all on the same page. So quantum mechanics. So quantum mechanics is some game where between preparations, unitary evolution, and measurement. The idea is you create a system in some state. It's given by some vector in a Hilbert space or maybe a projective Hilbert space. You evolve unitarily. We try to control this in some well-defined way. And in the end, you do some measurement, and this is where the outcome of your computation comes about. So you get some probabilistic outcome, and we call that the outcome of the computation. So, and then this probability is just given by some squared matrix element, or absolute value squared of a matrix element of this unitary. But what unitary do we allow? Okay, so really the way that we envision doing this sort of thing is that we have some sort of a quantum circuit that acts on some sequence of, let's say, qubits or elementary localized quantum systems. So here's an example of a circuit that came out of some recent work done in our group at Microsoft in an algorithm that's meant to solve problems in computational chemistry. The exact algorithm doesn't really matter, it's just an example. And so the idea is that we have here an example of, say, a circuit of 6 qubits. And each of these little guys here, we call it a gate. So these gates have names. So this H here is this 2x2 matrix. So in this talk, gates are 2x2 matrices, or maybe 4x4, or D by D. So unitary matrices. So this gate here we call a Hadamard gate. What it does is it takes a zero state and it puts it into a superposition, 0 plus 1, or take 1 into 0 minus 1. This Y is a Pauli sigma Y gate. So this here is a control, it's a Z rotation. It corresponds to a rotation about the Z direction in the spin 1/2 representation. This matrix right here shows up here. Here this is a controlled knot, the idea being that it flips the second bit, the second qubit, corresponding to the value of the first one. And similarly, we can control other things like a Z, the controlled Z here, that applies a Z gate or a sigma Z when the first qubit was in the state 1. And So this is an example of how we can kind of do a large unitary on many qubits by a bunch of smaller individual gates. But what sort of a system do we apply this to? So the way that we envision making a quantum computer is not necessarily by having a bunch of isolated systems that we protect from noise, but really these qubits, we imagine them as being sort of virtually encoded into some larger collection of systems like some kind of superconducting qubits like this. And we hope that if we make the systems clean enough, that is to say, if we can achieve some sort of physical gate fidelities within like the 99% range, physical errors getting below like 10 to the minus 2, that then a series of results known as the threshold theorems kick in. And we can do things like, by doing sort of encoding or doing codes with things like a color code and whatnot, that we could then do certain gates exactly for all intents and purposes. So this here is sort of the famous T gate. Okay, so another type of proposal that's on the table, and maybe what we'll ultimately end up doing is some mixture of these two, or these types of results, is that of taking some sort of collective excitations in some physical system that gives rise to, or that's described by a topological quantum field theory. So the idea being that if you have some excitations that live in 2+1 dimensions and you move them or braid these excitations or defects around each other, that you could then cause some unitary transformation to happen among their collective degrees of freedom or a topological Hilbert space. And so, for example, if I have 3 such defects that are described by, or that are so-called Fibonacci anions, I can cause a gate like this to occur. And in order to get universal quantum computation, you're going to want to have a non-abelian representation, ultimately, of like an n-strand braid group. And these can be achieved by braiding around anions in an SU2 level K Chern-Simons theory for appropriate K. And then in that case, you know, what your circuit is going to look like is some sort of a braid like this, where you sort of, you know, the creation phase here is where you, at least in principle, you create particle-antiparticle pairs out of a vacuum, you do some sort of braiding, and then at the end of the day, you bring them back together and see if they annihilate, and that's your measurement. And so this is your computational sequence, or this unitary matrix element winds up being proportional to some invariant of this link in 2 plus 1 dimensions. Okay. So generally, when we think about coding, we can take an abstract sense, and we can if we're faced with a given type of noise, we can ask, well, what's the best possible codes that exist against it? So here we're going to imagine just coding. So instead of
yes, we want to the abstract thing. So the practical thing, I just want to see what that implies. So how do you build on the thing on the right into? Is this the circuits?
So you should imagine, I mean, this is sort of a cartoon. I'm not sure you would actually do this in the real world. But you should imagine that there's some plane here. I think this is a poorly drawn picture for what I'm trying to achieve. And that this third direction is time.
Okay.
And these little kinks here are you have some anions that are being moved around each other as time goes down. Maybe you drag them around. It's more of a thought experiment. I mean, the way people envision doing this sort of thing with like Majorana fermions, which would be described by SU2 level 4, where you're not quite universal, but still it's a promising way of getting everything besides like a T-gate, but there's ways to get those too, would be to kind of have a bunch of like nanowires, and you can kind of make a T out of them. Mm-hmm. And the idea being that you can kind of move the defects and kind of do like a K-turn like you would in a car. So like you start out like this way, you go down here, and you come back up, and then over, and then that's the way you can kind of braid two defects around. And so people are actually trying to build this kind of stuff right now in a lab. So imagine now that I have some general noisy quantum process. Okay, so this might be this superconducting qubit that I drew on the slide before. You have, it interacts irreversibly or reversibly with some inaccessible environment. So this environment might just be some other physical modes that you don't have access to. And the idea being that any kind of quantum information you put in, maybe this is time instead of space, it can leak out. And if you don't have access to this environment, it manifests itself as noise. So mathematically, what this means is this. So if I have some unitary operator from an input Hilbert space into a tensor product of outputs, so this is A, this is the tensor product of B and E, it acts on the density matrix of the input by a quantum channel that is a trace-preserving, completely positive linear map. And so what that is you just kind of conjugate the density operator by this unitary, and then you trace out over the environment modes. This gives you a map from density operators on A to density operators on B. Okay, and the density matrix, of course, being a trace one, you know, Hermitian linear operator of positive semi-definite. And so one way that you can kind of view this is that if you put in a pure state, it produces a convex combination of pure states. So density operators can be viewed as convex combinations of pure states, often in many different ways. There's also a notion of purification, where you can purify any density matrix by including some larger system. Okay. So a code then in this very general setting, you should imagine that you have some array of logical qubits that are embedded into some other array of physical qubits, into some subspace of their total Hilbert space. And the idea being that we have some noise acting on each system, and we're assuming, at least in this setting, that the noise is independent and identically distributed. I get the same kind of channel acting on each one of the physical qubits, and in such a way that there should be some other operation, some other quantum operation here, also implemented in such a manner that I want to simulate the identity circuit between all these qubits. So just the circuit without any gates. Again, if you imagine doing this in time rather than space, it's a question of making a memory, okay, against this sort of noise, or at least in an encoded subspace here. And so the quantum capacity is defined as the maximum rate at which you can correct errors in the limit of the number of channels going to infinity. So that is, it's the maximum ratio between the number of encoded qubits divided by the number of physical qubits. And so what the quantum capacity measures is the ultimate limit to our ability to correct quantum errors against this sort of noise. So capacity was originally studied by Shannon for kind of motivated by questions in classical communication theory. And Shannon, one of the nice things about him defining this was that he actually was able to give a formula for the capacity, something that he could compute easily as a maximum mutual information across one copy of the channel. But unfortunately for us,
formula in terms of whatever parameterizes the channel?
Yeah, so in terms of some conditional probabilities. Yeah. So the channel would be like you have some input set X, some output set Y, and it's given in terms of probabilities P of Y given X. And so unfortunately, quantum mechanically, we don't have such a formula. There's no general formula known, but we know some bounds and we know some special cases. So just to give some examples, kind of one of the simplest types of noise you can imagine would be a qubit flip channel, a channel that with probability P, or probability 1 minus P doesn't touch your input state. With probability P, it flips it by a sigma X. Okay, so the quantum capacity for this channel is given by this formula here. It's 1 minus the binary entropy of P, or you know, 1 minus the entropy of a fair coin, or of a coin with parameter P. And if you plot it, it looks like this. So in particular, note that if the error probability is exactly a half, in which case this image here gets flattened down to a pancake, okay? Or sorry, not to a pancake, but to a line through the center. Then the capacity is zero. So you can send through the channel's completely useless. It winds up being. But on the other hand, the qubit depolarizing channel which is a very popular model for actually studying fault tolerant quantum computing, acts in a different way. It kind of homogeneously shrinks down the block sphere. So with probability 1 minus p, it does nothing. With probability p, it replaces it with a point at the center of the block sphere. And even for this very popular and simple model of a quantum channel, we have no idea for a formula for its capacity, but we have bounds. But it's even kind of more embarrassing than that. We don't even know when the capacity is equal to zero. So what we do know is that there's some threshold P star such that the capacity is zero for every depolarizing probability greater than that P star, where this P star is somewhere in this enormous range between a fourth and a third. And this third comes from essentially a no-cloning type bound. And this fourth comes from basically explicit codes that are it's really not codes that you would ever try to use, but it's more codes that you plug into some bound on a quantity called the coherent information. So it's even a stickier situation when it comes to zero capacity channels, in that zero capacity channels are not necessarily useless for quantum communication. So Graham Smith and I showed in 2008. That there exist pairs of quantum channels, each of which has zero capacity, but zero capacity for different reasons, in the sense that you can combine the channels together and do a joint encoder and decoder and obtain a channel that has positive capacity. So this kind of implies in some sense that, like, at least for quantum capacity, zero plus zero can be strictly greater than zero. And what this means is that the quantum capacity does not tell you everything that there is to know about the ability for a quantum channel or the utility of a quantum channel for transmitting quantum information. And the upshot of this is that for classical capacity, a channel has zero capacity if and only if the input and output are completely uncorrelated. So if there's any tiny bit of correlation, you can actually kind of leverage that to send classical information. And this is why we can do deep space communication if you're willing to wait long enough. But quantum mechanically, you need some. Just having some correlation is not enough. It needs to be the kind of the right kind. And so the original channels that we found were kind of a very special pair of channels. One was a channel that had zero capacity from a no cloning argument, and the other one had zero capacity due to something called a PPT criterion or positive partial transpose criterion. But it was sort of a mathematical example on some four-dimensional channel. I guess the other one was an erasure channel. But we found later, also with John Smolin, that there are examples of Gaussian quantum channels that have this behavior as well. So the Gaussian channel that we found is basically described by a circuit that looks like this. So one of them was a 50% beam splitter, which has zero capacity from a symmetry argument. And the other one was this channel with two inputs and where you put the vacuum into these two outputs here, and then you trace out these other guys here, these are beam splitters, these are phase shifters, and these here are some nonlinear squeezing elements. And so they do, at least the example we found, requires kind of world record squeezing on the scale of, say, 10 dB. So, but it does show that kind of it's sort of physically realistic in the sense that these are Gaussian channels. They take Gaussian states to Gaussian states of two bosonic modes. And it shows that perhaps this sort of superactivation effect might be useful in studying real-world quantum delays. Okay. Yes?
I mean, it seems to me that when you say something like that, then what you define as capacity is not really a useful or good definition, but somehow...
Well, you might think that, but there's a lot of justification for capacity being a good definition in the sense that there's many different ways that you can define it in terms of not just number of qubits protected, but you can define it in terms of amount of entanglement that you could transmit over a channel. You can mess with the different error criteria in different ways, and you always get the same definition. So it just shows that you might need something more than, well, there's definitely more to the picture. So sometimes, yes, you're right. But we don't really know what that is yet. So it's kind of I'd say it's an outstanding challenge. And I'll say that this whole notion of non-additivity has been found in like over 100 different papers since we published this. So it's kind of a generic property of quantum channels in some sense.
I guess the thing, as you said, if there is no correlation between input and output, then there's nothing you can do. But if
right.
there is any type of correlation, there's something you can do about it, maybe by
right.
combining it with other.
Right, but we don't have a full story yet, and there's a lot of work to be done.
Well, the strictly classical channels, it doesn't matter how many classical channels you put together, you can't make a quantum channel. So you need more than just some correlation.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So,
but if there's any correlation, then it's the capacity is not zero, right?
The quantum capacity is zero. You can have
some correlation, the quantum capacity will be zero,
but to exactly quantify what that is, versus not, I mean, we kind of mostly just have examples still. We don't really have a general theory that works out. But there are families of quantum channels for which we can compute the capacity and everything works out really nicely. But my point in driving this home is that depolarizing noise is something people use to benchmark real quantum computers, and yet depolarizing noise is among the simplest types of noise, and that's why people use it. But even for that, we don't have a good optimal theory of codes. So it's sort of like the binary symmetric channel of quantum information, and we don't have a complete story for that yet. So, but so far everything I'm saying here is really just about channels that don't do anything. Okay, this is how do you simulate the identity circuit? So what we really care about ultimately, if we want to build a quantum computer, is error correcting non-trivial circuits. So quantum circuits like this. So again, this comes from some recent paper out of our group for doing a quantum variational eigensolver. And so part of the algorithm is that they need to be able to do arbitrary rotations by some theta that you kind of specify later on. Okay, so I'll mention two things about this. So first of all, in practice, it's okay if we can do these within some reasonable error. So if each gate can be done with some epsilon that's, say, I mean, people argue, it's just sort of controversial, but I've numbers like 10 to the minus 6 get thrown around, that people think that maybe you could actually solve something interesting that you couldn't easily do on a standard computer if you get gate fidelities in this range, and certainly if you get much higher than 10 to the minus 16. But this is really far away from any, you know, experiments now are in like the 10 to the minus 2 range, okay? So if you could somehow error correct from 10 to the minus 2, bootstrap up to here, it might make sense to start trying to build these things. Okay, but then we're left with a big open question here, which is we don't know how to correct errors for a continuous family of gates. And there's actually sort of no-go theorems that tell us that under certain assumptions that you can't do this. So that you can kind of only do a finite set of gates. So how do we get around this? So luckily, though, it's not quite so bad because there are... We do know how to do fault tolerant or error correction against for certain discrete sets of gates. So, for example, you know, here's the Pauli matrices here, the Pauli gates, and here, adding in what they call a phase gate in Hadamard, we get the Clifford group, or the qubit Clifford group these generate. And the qubit Clifford group, the finite group, It's not quite enough for doing universal computation. You need to get something that's going to generate a dense subgroup. At least if you want to do arbitrary qubit rotations up to within any like within an arbitrary degree of accuracy. So if you throw in this T, you get what people call Clifford plus T, and this generates a dense subgroup, and you can actually approximate an arbitrary unitary to any degree of accuracy that you'd like. And there's various fault-tolerant protocols that can produce other gates, like square roots of T and further roots of T, so it's sometimes advantageous if you can have access to these guys too, because you can kind of converge faster on any degree of accuracy. So another set of gates that I'll talk about much later or much more in this talk is what people have started calling the V basis, and these really come from algebraic number theory, in particular non-commutative number theory. They're derived from the theory of quaternion algebras. And to give away a bit of a punchline, I'm going to tell you how these guys here, and really kind of all this stuff, can be derived from quaternion algebras over number fields. So just to give another example of types of gates, so Fibonacci anions, braiding of three Fibonacci anions, we can give a fusion basis, that's dimension 2, and we can achieve these gates by, say, braiding the first two or braiding the second two in a counterclockwise twist. And these guys also generate a dense subgroup. And here, this phi is the golden ratio. And just a different kind of gate set. People call these the generalized Pauli matrices. I'll say a bit about these in the end of the talk. And they can come up in, let's say, if you have a quantum Hall system on a torus, and you can create, you know, particle-antiparticle pairs and wrap them around the torus and re-annihilate them, you can cause a global, you know, d-dimensional Hilbert space to transform according to these gates here. And these are also used to kind of describe, to give kind of a, what's known as like the generalized Clifford group, like the normalizer of these guys. So assuming that we can do certain gates exactly, how do you get arbitrary ones? Well, you get them by compiling. And essentially, the main point of this talk is I want to tell you guys about the fact that we have a polynomial time algorithm that can find an epsilon approximation of an arbitrary unitary in SU2 with a circuit that grows like order log 1 over epsilon, and this is optimal. And we can do this over a very general class of gate sets. It's optimal up to constant factors, that is. And so the algorithm I'll tell you about, it generalizes, you know, most existing known algorithms that do this for specific gate sets. Now, the underlying mathematics has roots in computer science and also in number theory, and it comes from the theory of how to construct explicit expanding graphs, Ramanujan expanders. That was kind of the original application of this machinery in computer science. And it's conceivable, and I think likely, that this sort of methods could lead to new algorithms or new tools for designing fault-tolerant protocols. And really, I think that the overarching theme is that it gives us some sense of a look at what you might call like the science of what it is to be a good quantum gate set. So what's the problem? So the general compiling problem is this. We assume that we have some fault-tolerant quantum computer, and we assume we have some list of gates, just unitaries. Most of this talk should be about qubits, that we can do exactly. Okay, so this U1 through UM, and just assume that there's some cost associated to these in the most general sense of this problem. And so, for example, if we had Clifford plus T, in most physical realizations that people have in mind, doing the Clifford gates shouldn't be too hard, but doing T gates might require some sort of magic state distillation protocols that require many concatenated layers of error correction. And so you'd want to really minimize the number of T's that it takes because they can be very expensive from a protocol sense. Then you have some target unitary you want to do, and you want to approximate it. So how do you do this? Well, you have to find some sequence of unitaries from your set that you know how to do exactly that can approximate it within epsilon, and you want to minimize the cost. Okay, So the cost here is, of some sequence, just the sum of the costs of the individual guys. And really, for the most sense, we'll think of the cost as each guy having one, but you can vary that. So this problem has a solution precisely when this makes sense. Okay, so, and what that means mathematically is that the group generated by these guys is dense. Okay, so for every epsilon, that there exists some sequence that gets you within epsilon of the target, for every target. Okay, so you might say, well, you could just do brute force search, okay? Just list out all the possible gate sets that you could do. But I mean, this can be impractical because you'd have to store an exponential amount of stuff because the number of sequences grows exponentially.
So this, isn't this like serial computing as opposed to parallel computing, as you could have, I mean, instead of just one of these products, you could have multiple of them?
I mean, if you imagine you had many different qubits you were acting on simultaneously, yeah, you could do it in parallel, one on the other on the other.
Because this U
but,
is...
But I'm just taking SU2
here.
Okay,
so yeah. It's a soft passive thing that could do, yeah.
Right. And it's already hard enough for qubits in some sense. So
yeah. In the Clifford plus T group, there's like a discrete set of gates, and then you have one gate that's like a, basically a free parameter. Is that how you make it dense?
Well, not so much a free parameter. It's just you have the T. And so what you can show is that the Clifford group, the image of that, or it's basically, it's a maximal finite subgroup of SU2. So, because you can classify all the finite subgroups, and so you know if you add in anything else, it's going to be dense. And so the T-gate is the one standard one that people in quantum computing have been using for a long time. And I'm not really sure why people were looking at T, but this talk will give kind of a very clear way of realizing that maybe gives some sense of why T really was kind of the right thing that people found. So kind of the standard textbook approach to this problem has been known as the Soloveitch-Kataev algorithm. And so the basic idea is that it successively refines like a net on your space of unitaries by using commutators. And it gives you circuits that grow in length polylog 1 over epsilon, and it finds them in order polylog 1 over epsilon time. And but the constants are like, you know, the circuit length grows like log to the fourth. And so it's all well and good, but when you actually crunch the numbers, as people did when they really started to think about building these things, they got kind of depressing gate counts. And just to throw some numbers out there, I'm told that like if you wanted to do a rotation by 2 pi over 64 using Clifford plus T, so this T gate is actually it's a rotation about like the z-axis by 2 pi over 8. So it's an eighth of a rotation. If you wanted to do a 64th, to within error, you know, epsilon is 10 to the minus 16, you're going to need something like 15,000 T gates if you just use like the best known implementations of Soloveitch-Kataev. And on the other hand, there's a volume argument that tells you that you only need log 1 over epsilon times a constant to that good approximations should exist if you have a circuit that grows in this length. So rather than order the log one over epsilon to the fourth. So the question is, well, can you achieve it? And so it's known that you can achieve it in certain settings. So if you have a gate set, let's say call it the script G, and we use it to average, so we can define something called a Heket operator, which is an averaging function, an averaging operator on the space of functions on the sphere. So if you just take, you know, L2 of the sphere, this decomposes into spherical harmonics, you know, spin 0, spin 1, spin 2, spin 3. And each gate acts by translating such functions, and it commutes with this direct sum decomposition. So if you average over these guys, this then gives you some linear operator on this space that actually breaks up into blocks. And it turns out that the gate set is going to grow exponentially. So the group generated by your gate set will grow exponentially fast precisely when this Heket operator is gapped. So when there's some uniform, so when you forget about the constant subspace, if there's some uniform constant so that the top eigenvalue in all these other spaces, its absolute value that is strictly bounded below 1 for some uniform constant, then you basically get rapid mixing in a sense. And what that translates to is order log 1 over epsilon scaling. And so an explicit construction of basically what wound up being this V basis was given by Lubovsky, Phillips, and Sarnak in the 80s. And again, their application was for making expanding graphs and also for giving an explicit construction of paradoxical decompositions of the sphere as arise in the Banach-Tarski paradox. But the fact that this gate set would be useful for quantum computing was first noted by Harrow, Reck, and Chang in 2001, but they didn't give an efficient way of actually doing the rounding off. They just kind of pointed out that that you would at least know of the existence of good approximations, and they showed how to generalize it to higher dimensions as well. But I think this was already known. But so more recently, Borgen and Gambor proved that if you have a gate set all of whose entries are algebraic, so the matrix elements are algebraic, then you're always going to satisfy this Gap-Hecke operator property. So algebraic numbers, these are numbers that are the root, a number is algebraic if it's the root of some polynomial with integer coefficients, okay? And so luckily, essentially, everything that we come across is algebraic. So, you know, I is a square root of minus one, so x squared, x squared minus one, they're the roots of x squared minus one. Roots of unity are roots of like, x to the n minus one. The golden ratio is algebraic. And also there's a general theorem in topological field theory, it's called Vafa's theorem, which tells us that the topological spins in a TQFT are roots of unity. They're algebraic numbers. And so you can plug those into things like the formula for the S matrix, which you can use to derive braiding. And the quantum dimensions wind up being algebraic integers. And so algebraic numbers kind of naturally fall out of that framework. So again, that's all well and good, but you still have this question of can we actually find an efficient, or can we find an approximation efficiently in a reasonable amount of time without just counting gates and storing everything ahead of time and doing brute force search. And so there was kind of a bunch of breakthroughs happened in like starting in 2012, where it's first found by Klyushnikov, Maslov, and Mosca that you can do this for the Clifford plus T gate set. And they gave they used number theory to show how to do this rounding off efficiently and to show that they could compile the result. And so they did this by requiring some ancillas. Selinger, very shortly after, removed the ancillas. They did ancilla-free. And Ross Selinger even showed that with an oracle for factoring, that they could find the optimal circuit, which is somewhat ironic given the application. So for this V basis, Botrov, Gorovitch, and Savor gave kind of an analogous result where they could, again, do the optimal, where they could do the rounding off, and the compiling kind of comes for free, as we'll see. And also, and shortly after their follow-up work, when Vadim came and was a postdoc with our group, they kind of solved the same problem for Fibonacci anions. But is there some common generalization of all this stuff? Do you have to kind of keep finding a new algorithm every time you think of a new gate set? And so there's kind of a general method that all these things shared that really was kind of pioneered in this very first paper, which is to break the problem up into two parts. Okay, so what are the requirements? Well, the first requirement is that we have a dense subgroup, so we have some hope to approximate. The second is that you have to be able to characterize all your circuits of length n, so or all the things that you can get with length n circuits, and the whole group itself, so you have a chance of rounding. And you also have to be able to do factoring inside of this finitely generated subgroup, i.e. you have to be able to compile into products of the gates. And so they did this two-step process where first what you do is what they call approximate synthesis. So you take the unitary and you round it off into the set of unitaries that have circuits of length n. And so we have a recent paper where we do this for a very general gate set. This is also with Klyushnikov and Rutler and Alex Botrov. And the second step is that you take that. Yes?
You might have said this, but by rounding it, you mean like you find the nearest element of that group?
Essentially, yeah. You may not be able to find the nearest, but you find something that's near enough, yeah. And then so the second step is that once you've done that rounding off, you need to compile. And so in a paper with Vadim Klyushnikov from about a year ago, we gave kind of a very general method for kind of engineering gate sets that allow you to do kind of a version of trial division that lets you do this compilation very efficiently. And so all these results that have followed kind of have followed this. But so what kind of a natural data structure might exist that lets you do this? And so for qubits, the answer is quaternions. So quaternions were famously discovered by Hamilton, who was kind of obsessed with generalizing complex numbers to describe three-dimensional rotations instead of two-dimensional rotations. And so the story goes that he spent a long time trying to find a generalization, and one night, while his wife was dragging him home from the bar, he realized he needed quadruples. He needed four numbers and not three. So he supposedly scrawled these three numbers into this bridge because he thought he wouldn't remember, and they had to put a plaque there to commemorate it. They put I squared equals J squared equals K squared equals minus one, and these guys have to anti-commute. Okay, so mathematically, what quaternions are useful for is they let you one way to look at it is they let you kind of explicitly describe this covering map from SU2 to SO3. So, so a quaternion is some real linear combination of just 1 and I, J, and K. And what you do is you take, you know, your quaternion, and then you plug in, you know, I times the Pauli matrices for I, J, and K. And then what you have to do is you get something that, whose determinant is not 1, so you need to renormalize it. And it turns out that the determinant of this guy here is the same as the length of this vector in R4. So, or I should say, so you have to take the square root of that, and then you get an element of SU2. And so we'll see in this talk that the norm of a quaternion is going to, so this extra free parameter, we essentially use it as a measure of complexity. So the length winds up corresponding to complexity in a well-defined way. And so here's our map from, you know, this cross here. This means the multiplicative group of this ring of quaternions. So it's everything that has an inverse that's still in this ring. And so that's how you get from the non-zero quaternions to SU2. How do you get to SO3? Well, what you do is you take a complex quaternion or a pure quaternion, one without a constant part, and you can define a rotation algebraically. You take, you know, R of Q of this 3 vector is just Q times the 3 vector times Q inverse. And so what we find is that for the, you know, for the unitaries, we get a homomorphism. So the product of two unitaries corresponding to different quaternions is the unitary corresponding to the product. And it's invariant up to scalar factors that are positive. So if you have a negative, you pick up a minus sign. But then if you do the same thing for the covering map to SO3, it's invariant for all R. So this reflects the fact that you have a 2-to-1 cover. Okay, so this guy doesn't see the -1. And so you get this sequence. So I'll use this notation U sub Q and R sub Q throughout the talk to mean the image of a quaternion in SU2 or its corresponding image in SO3. Okay, so that's the quaternions. But so quaternions over the real numbers are not really that useful. I mean, people use them in computer graphics. In physics, it's maybe more of kind of a fringe topic. But what quaternions are really useful for is for doing arithmetic. And so here's this V basis. Okay, so it comes from something called the Lipschitz quaternion order, where now we make the coordinates integers. And then now is where things really start to get interesting. So now we have this ring, so it's closed under multiplication and addition, but not necessarily inverses. So this L cross here, this is called the multiplicative group of these guys, and there's 8 units in this group. So there's 8 guys that have an inverse. And what it corresponds to, or it's isomorphic to the quaternion group, it's an order 8 non-commutative group. And it's basically the Pauli group. That is, if you take the image under this unitary normalizing map, there's no normalization because the norms are already 1, right? It's just, you know, plus or minus I, and then plus or minus the 3 Pauli, plus or minus I times the Pauli matrices, okay? And then if you take the image, you know, in SO3, it's just the Klein 4 group. Now you lose these phases. Now it becomes commutative. Okay? So that's the Lipschitz quaternions. This is its unit group. It's basically the guys that sit on the unit circle in R4. And then now, what about the, let's now look at the quaternions in here that have norm 5, or that have length 5. So it turns out there's 24 of them. And if we then mod out by this 8 element unit group here, we're left with 6. 1 plus or minus 2i, 1 plus or minus 2j, 1 plus or minus 2k. And actually, if we take the images of these quaternions under the unitary normalizing map, we get what people call the V basis. Okay, so this matrix, and this matrix, and their inverses. And then if you take further the images in SO3, what these are rotations about the x, y, and z axes by arc cosine of -3/5. So it's some irrational rotation, basically. And what's kind of beautiful about these guys is the following. So let's now consider not just the quaternions that have norm 5, but let's take the set of all quaternions whose norm is some power of 5 now, the quaternions in here that have norm power of 5. So if I do that, and I plug this, now it's a monoid, it's multiplicatively closed, but doesn't have inverses. If I plug that into my unitary normalizing map, I basically get that this is, you know, plus or minus times the group generated by these V basis. And then if I take the image in SO3, And it turns out that it's actually isomorphic to the three group, the free group on three generators. But even better yet, there's actually explicit ways of characterizing this image. So it's an example of what mathematicians call an arithmetic group. That is, you take SO3, not with elements from the reals, but elements from this particular ring. So what this means is, this notation means the integers times any power you want of 1/5. So it's basically numbers that are integers, except that you're allowed to divide by 5, however many times you like. And so the group of all 3x3 orthogonal matrices over this ring is exactly equal to the group generated by these rotation matrices.
You take the power of 1/5
and
divide by 5.
You divide by all powers of 1/5, so you can divide by all powers of 5, yeah.
Oh, okay, I see.
Time powers of 1/5, yeah. This is inverting. Okay. Yeah. And also, this winds up being the same thing as the projective, you know, special unitary group over this ring here. But you kind of, but it doesn't work if you get the get rid of the P, so there's some phases that get screwed up. And so why is this important that this is a free group? Well, it gives you a very simple way of doing compilation. So essentially, you can compile, so anything in here, you can compute its norm, okay, of a course. So what you do is you kind of kill off the denominators. You compute the norm, and the norm tells you precisely how long the sequence is of you know, V-basis matrices that you need. So it means that you're going to be somewhere out on this tree. So this is some you know, 6 regular tree that describe multiplication by this V basis. And so you're somewhere out here, and what you do is you just try dividing by one of the 6 V basis elements, and there'll be precisely one that makes the norm go down. Then you repeat. And then so it takes you basically a linear amount of time to do this compilation compilation by essentially trial division. And so I'll mention that actually everything on this slide works if you replace 5 with any prime that's 1 mod 4. So all the arithmetic goes through. That's the only thing that's special about 5. And so there's a much more general theory of this stuff that works over, you know, it's known as the theory of Bruhat-Tetz trees. And there's a great book by Sarah about this called Trees. If you ever wondered what this book was about, this is exactly what it's about. And so other applications of this, I should say, so it gives an explicit way of describing what people call like a paradoxical decomposition of the sphere, where you break it up into some finite number of parts that all have the same volume, but then you plug them back together, you get, you know, twice the volume or something. And so Lobatsky, Phillips, and Sarnak use this explicit description of these guys to basically give a like an effective version of one of these decompositions. And also, so I mentioned Harrow, Rechtin, Chang, and this Botrov, Gorovitz 4 use this stuff in quantum computing. Okay, so this is the V basis. What about Clifford group? Okay, so it turns out that you can actually generalize this stuff to the Clifford group if you now work with quaternion algebras over number fields instead of just over the rationals. So what you get here now is we consider the base ring to be basically, so what this z root 2 means is this is all integer, it's basically all integer polynomials in square root of 2 with integer coefficients. So it's all numbers of the form a plus b times the square root of 2. And as you can see, if you multiply two of those out, basically, you know, square root of 2 squared becomes an integer. So you just have kind of it's like a rank 2 z lattice, basically. And so again, I squared plus j squared, you know, I squared equals j squared equals k squared equals minus 1. And we have here this, it's like a 4-dimensional lattice over this ring. But as a lattice over the integers, it's 8-dimensional. And actually, it's actually my favorite realization of the E8 root lattice. So the idea is that the E8 root lattice with respect to the standard Euclidean norm is obtained by you take this set of numbers here and you compute what's called, so you take the norm or the length of the quaternion, you get something that lives inside of, you know, this ring here, z adjoined the square root of 2. But then what you have to do is you have to take what's called the field trace. And this is kind of like an analog of taking the twice the real part of a complex number. So what is, if you have some number x plus y square root of 2, you add that number to its Galois conjugate, where you know you take square root of 2 here and minus square root of 2 there, and you get twice kind of the, you know, the rational part of the number. And so if you plug that in here, you get a really beautiful realization of E8. Okay. And so now it turns out that if you take the unit group of this guy and you take it under this unitary normalizing map, you get precisely the 48-element binary octahedral group, what we call the cubic Clifford group. And just in math speak, what it is it's just, you take the multiplicative group of this guy mod powers of this number here, which is called the fundamental unit. Because it turns out that the whole unit group of this z root 2 is plus or minus these kinds of numbers. And just to write it out, here's the 48 elements. And just, you know, these are proportional to like sigma x, y, and z. Here's your Hadamard, here's your phase gate, for example. And again, if you take, you know, the image in SO3, you get the octahedral group, which is the symmetries of either the octahedron or the cube. And that's this group right here. Okay, so that's just the unit group, okay? But where's the T-gate in all this? And so the T-gate is essentially the guise of norm square root of 2. But I say essentially because there's really no elements of norm square root of 2. It's elements that generate a principal ideal that's the same as the one generated by square root of 2. So what does this mean? So this notation here means it's basically all numbers in the ring of the form, you know, x times this ring. So this is called a principal ideal. And so that's this notation here. And so there's essentially six T gates, you know, rotations by 1/8 of a turn left or right around the x, y, or z axis. And they're the images of these quaternions here, where you replace I with, you know, plus or minus I, j, or k. Okay? And so I define this set of quaternions here, which is an analog of these ones from the V basis that have norm power of 5. Now it's one norms that generate an ideal. That's a power of this principal ideal here. And then it turns out that the Clifford plus T group is exactly equal to the image of this set under the unitary normalizing map. And then now if you take the image, you know, if you throw out phases, you get projective unitaries over this ring here. And actually, this was proved, this characterization here was proved in this initial paper by Klyshnikov, Maslov, and Mosca in 2012. And last year, Peter Sarnak was actually here. I wasn't here, but I saw this online. He gave a talk at IQC, and he called this fact a miracle that these guys proved this. He said it's a miracle that Clifford plus T is arithmetic. And the reason he said this is that it's, in general, whenever you take some finitely generated group, it's more often than not, actually, with probability 1, it's going to have infinite index in such an arithmetic group. And given a finitely generated group, it's even undecidable to decide if its image is arithmetic or not, unless you engineer it as such. So I mean, maybe it's not such a miracle, because I think this fact that you have this finitely generated group that is actually arithmetic, that is of this form, is probably implicitly why people were using these in quantum information without quite realizing it. So also, I'll just mention that, you know, in SO3, it has also this nice form here. Okay, well, this is just the image of this under the rotations. So this can all be generalized to the setting where you now have, you know, a quaternion algebra over some number field. And again, so just to give a more formal definition, a number field is some finite dimensional rational vector space of solutions to polynomials. So you've probably come across them inadvertently when you ask Mathematica to solve something for you and it spits back one of these horrible looking root objects. So what is this? This is some data structure, right? It's just telling you, well, there's some polynomial, it's degree 10, and I have some ordering on the roots and it's the second root of that. And actually, it's actually, as far as the computer knows, it's a very concise and actually precise and exact data structure for describing a number. And so you can do exact arithmetic on these types of numbers, and essentially algebraic number theory is the study of such algebraic numbers. So inside of a number field, you have a subring of integers, which I'll write z sub f, and what it is it's all the guys that are the root of some polynomial with leading coefficient 1. So actually this here is describing an algebraic integer. Okay, and what's nice is that inside a number field, that there's if you take all the guys that are integral that satisfy something like this, they form a ring. So there's a unique ring of integers. But more generally, if you talk about rational algebras, like non-commuting algebras, as we shouldn't be surprised that we need in quantum computing, what you find is that things get a little more hairy. So namely, if you just take integrality as your main condition, you find that they're not even additively closed, let alone form a ring. But then if you throw in a constraint that you have to, so a non-commuting ring of integers is called an order. And these guys are, they're partially ordered, and then the maximal ones in there are called maximal orders. And what it winds up being is like an integral basis for your algebra, that also has a ring structure on it. And the price that you pay by going to non-commuting is that these things are not unique, because you can kind of take a maximum order and rotate it and get another one. But it's precisely this rotation, or keeping track of these rotations, that kind of lets us generalize this notion of compiling from just these other cases to really a huge generalization of cases. So namely, what we do is we use these as a machine for producing something mathematicians call an S-arithmetic group. So what this is we take, we fix a maximal order inside of quaternion algebra. That's, we now also allow I squared and J squared to equal A and B, where these are just some numbers in the field, not just minus one. And we take the image of that. So we take the image of a certain set under this unitary normalizing map. Namely, we have S be some finite set of prime ideals in this ring. And then what we do is we take the set of all guys in this order such that the ideal generated by their norm factors into a product of primes that are just in that set S. Okay, so for example, this V basis, the set S just contains the ideal generated by 5. For Clifford plus T, it's this basis here. But now we can do all sorts of things. Like we can kind of combine Clifford plus T plus V, for example, by lumping both of these together, for example. So there's deep theorems in mathematics. So like Burrell and Harish Chandra proved in 1961 that all such arithmetic groups, or S-arithmetic groups as they're called, that they're all finitely generated. And they were actually all proved to be finitely presented, which means that not only do they have finitely many generators, but there's actually a reduction theory, or in other words, that the set of relations satisfied by the generators is finite. And this was proved in 1980, but really it wasn't really a good effective proof. So what we did in our paper, my paper with Vadim, is we gave kind of the first explicit effective method for computing sets of generators that allow trial division, or i.e. doing good reduction theory, when the set S has more than one prime in it. So when you're away from the setting of these trees, and when the algebra has at most one embedding into the 2x2 real matrices. It's known as, that's kind of a technical condition. It has at most one split real prime. So I'll just say, just gloss over a little bit about how this algorithm works. The idea is that you pick some maximal order, and then there's some quaternion you want to factor, so you rotate the maximal order by that. And then factoring kind of corresponds to pathfinding. So this is sort of what it would look like in a tree. And and you kind of use like the non-commutative ideal theory of these orders to do these factorizations. But then you can have further complications, which is that in kind of more complicated settings, not all the vertices are even conjugate. So you have to kind of build some graph that tells you about like the different kinds of orders, or different isomorphism classes of orders that you have. So already if you look at Clifford plus square root of T, which comes up in certain fault-tolerant protocols, you have two types of orders, and you kind of have to track, and you get to a leaf that's one that was conjugate, then you know that you have a quaternion that you can kind of pull off from your trial division. But then I'll say that even for Clifford plus a fourth root of T, we have apparently 56 types of maximal orders. So already there's a lot to be done even in trying to make a connection between this machinery and such protocols that use those. Like they call this the Clifford hierarchy, where this stuff comes up. And then also when you have more than one prime, you don't get a tree anymore. It doesn't quite look like this for these, but you get a structure called a building instead of a tree. And so how does the rounding off work? So back to kind of the first step, that was the second step of compiling. So just again, we kind of consider, at least here for a simple case, where F is some number field that's totally real, so it only has real embeddings, and we have some quaternion algebra that is totally definite, which is to say that it has no embeddings into the 2x2 reals, at least for this setting. We fix some maximal order, and we just do it with one prime, and we have our arithmetic group. And we want to do a rotation by phi, to within a degree of accuracy, epsilon. So the algorithm should find some quaternion that gets within epsilon, and such that the norm satisfies an equation like this, where the length is, so the norm has some power of L, where L satisfies this kind of equation, and where the C is some effective constant that can be computed ahead of time. And so roughly the way it works, I mean, there's a lot involved in this, but I'll just to give you some ideas, that we kind of fill in the coordinates piece by piece. So we do the diagonal part first, okay? And we do this by, we sample points from some, so we take, if F was the, our real field that we started with, A was this thing that I squared equals A. We have an extension field of this, which is an example of what people call a CM field, or complex multiplication field. It's totally imaginary extension of a totally real number field. And we sample points from some convex body that kind of looks like this. And you know, each point is a possible one where you could fill in the remaining points here, but there's some issues. Namely that, after we do some reshaping to make sure that we have some good chance of finding good samples. And it could be that there's nothing that fills this in, and it could be that it could be hard to solve it. And we basically post-select on the different possibilities. So there are some cases where we can tell there's not a solution. There's some cases where it's computationally hard to tell, and there's some cases where it's easy to tell there is a solution. So we can find those, and up to some number theoretic conjecture, it turns out that those easy cases happen often enough. Just to kind of mention, so some of this machinery also works for Fibonacci's, but we don't quite have a good approximation story in this framework yet. So what we can actually show, kind of a byproduct of this investigation, we found that like the image of the Fibonacci break group representation is arithmetic, or S arithmetic. So namely, if you take the image of the even subgroup, or the even numbers of twists of the three-strand break group, it actually all winds up being stuck in the unit group of this order, which is kind of different than these other examples I showed you where the unit groups were finite. So we kind of need different methods for computing in the unit group. And the full image actually is S arithmetic, where we now have the prime ideal here, generated by the square root of 5. But then there's some added issues that this thing is not unitary under all embeddings, because this guy has some real embeddings and some complex embeddings. And maybe I just kind of want to mention some kind of very different flavor of work, but it's definitely related to this machinery. And to be honest, I learned a lot of this machinery while trying to attack this problem. But we have a recent paper out with Marcus Appleby, Steve Flamia, Aaron McConnell, and myself about this problem that has been studied and talked a lot about here at PI, which is this question of finding symmetric, informationally complete quantum measurements. And so the idea is this, is if I have d complex dimensions, or a qudit, imagine I have n pure states, they're all normalized, such that they have the same squared inner product, say alpha. Okay, and this alpha has to be less than 1 because I'm assuming they're different. So it's easy to prove that if you have n such states, that there's at most d squared of them. What you do is you kind of form a grand matrix of their projections with respect to the Hilbert-Schmidt product, and you compute its rank, and you see that it can't be greater than d squared. And then you can also show, it's not too hard, that if there happen to be d squared of them, then this overlap has to be 1/(d+1). But the big open question is, can this always be achieved? And the surprising thing is that yes, is what the answer looks like. And it's surprising because if you ask the analog question for like lines in real space, you get some bound and it's known to not always be achieved. And so it doesn't seem to be any kind of uniformity in the solutions. But it turns out that if you take, that you can always apparently find some vector that people call a fiducial vector, and you take the orbit under the generalized Pauli group, so up to phase there's d squared such vectors then. And if you kind of numerically optimize, you can find that up to dimensions, I think I'm hearing up to 323, I'm told, that solutions exist. It seems that every dimension up to like maybe 130, people have found numerics. But what's really interesting is that we have mathematical proofs in these dimensions here so far. And these mathematical proofs, of course, are done by doing explicit computations over very high degree number fields in magma that sometimes take a lot of computational power just to check. And but what's even more interesting is that the number fields that come up, which were initially found by kind of just solving Grobner bases, actually seem to have some pattern. And this pattern sort of indicates that these are number fields that were not well understood mathematically, and that this problem may provide a new way in for computing these problems that has been kind of interest to people like Hilbert for over 100 years. So namely, it seems that each fiducial vector that generates a sick POVM is such that if I take the ratios of the non-zero coordinates and I take the polynomials in those over the rational numbers, you get what's called the minimal field of definition of this point in projective space. And if you take either the Galois closure, let's just say if you take all d squared vectors in an orbit, and you take the field that contains all those, that this field has a name, or it seems to contain something that people call the Ray class field of this specific field that has a specific conductor. And I'd say it's just some generalization of a field of roots of unity to, from extensions of the rationals to billion extensions of real quadratic fields. And there's a lot that's known about, computing a billion extensions of imaginary quadratic fields, or even these so-called complex multiplication fields, that is, totally imaginary extensions of totally real number fields. But while there's a general theory that lets you kind of implicitly describe these fields, there's no way of known how to explicitly generate them, apart from those examples of like imaginary quadratics and their generalizations. But for real quadratics, there's really been, like, nothing's been known. And there's even conjectural units called Stark units that are conjectured to generate these fields, but nobody can prove it. So we kind of have from the other side that we were looking for these constructions that people are having trouble proving that they exist, and they seem to have these same kind of magical properties. So it points at not only a link between these problems, but it kind of tells us where the techniques are that we should look for solving them. So so on that, I think I'm about out of time. So just thank you all for listening, and to say that, so what did we see? We saw that, quantum capacity can be super activated. I told you guys about a polynomial time algorithm for compiling optimal length circuits over a very general class of gate sets, and also for approximating them. A general method for producing qubit gate sets that allow you to do this kind of trial division. And I mentioned this recent result about POVMs, and it's called Hilbert's 12th problem for real quadratic fields, just the specific problem that this has a relevance to. And so in the future, I could see this kind of method being used to generate, beyond qubit, but qdit, and maybe multi-qubit codes, but there's even more to be done there. And I think that these will probably be necessary techniques for future developments and development of fault-tolerant quantum computing and studying to the Clifford hierarchy. I would also expect that this is where we're going to find new quantum algorithms, because we have a very rich mathematical theory there that there's a lot to draw from. Like one example is, I think that we should be able to construct explicit families of quantum expanders, and maybe actually prove existence of sick PVMs. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
What is qdit?
Oh, like d-dimensional qubits.
What does POVM stand for?
Oh, that's symmetric, informationally complete, positive operator value measures. So not everybody likes this word, but this is, if you Google it, this is what you find the most of. So.
Only very naive question, but if I understood you right, what you're trying to do is optimize a particular two-qubit operation. But when you're computing, you have many, many qubits, and you're really interested in the end product. You don't really care about optimizing any given operation. You shouldn't be optimizing the whole circuit.
Well, it's what we can do so far.
Yes.
So, it's, it's future work is to look at higher dimensional. That's why I said qdit. I mean, in some sense, Q 2 to the n, d with 2 to the n is ultimately what you'd want. But the real question is, an experimentalist is going to tell you, this is what I can do. What can I do with it?
Yeah.
So a mathematician might say, well, this is what you need to do. And then they might say, well, too bad. And you'd like to have some theory that you can fall back on, because there are some cases where, for example, with these V bases, maybe you can only do 2 out of the 3. And if that's the case, I actually don't know how to, and it may actually be provably impossible to do an optimal compilation for 2 out of the 3 V bases, for example, because they wind up having infinite index inside this group of 3. So kind of rounding off into that set might be too hard. So that might be a case where I would tell the experimentalist, no, you really need to be able to do this other rotation too. But you're right. 2 qubits is really kind of where the big question is now. And you might have some specific interaction you can do. And then it's up to the mathematicians to say, well, figure out what they can do, they can extract from it.
So there's a result that shows that if you stick to real amplitude states, you can still do universal quantum computation. There's a few papers about that. I just wonder if your formalism provides an elegant way of seeing, you know, a new kind of proof of that result.
Well, for the most part, this is about single qubit,
right,
though. So, I mean, a lot of these universality results are about kind of, they often fall back on like a single qubit operation being dense, and then, right, you have some entangling gate or something. Maybe there's some connection, but. So which result are you talking about?
I can't remember everybody, but.
Or it's like Toffoli's and H's or something, right? And Hadamard's, or just.
Yeah, I don't remember the gate sets that achieve it, but there's at least three independent groups that.
I mean, it's not so much about proving the density. It's more about finding like the shortest circuits. So my guess would be it's easier to somehow prove density than to kind of fall back on this sort of heavy machinery.
Near the beginning, Mara's introductory part, you quoted some estimate, I think, from Kitaev, some people that gave a poly load, found that it ended up to be many thousands of, I forget.
Yeah.
So this goes down to like 16, or does this go with this new?
Oh, I think I didn't actually say that. It goes down to like 150 or even 50. Yeah, I should have. I think I said it. Maybe I said it, and I don't remember saying it. But
you definitely mentioned those numbers. There we go. Oh, okay.
Oh, I did. Yeah. So you get down to like 150 T gates, or even like you can use like quantum computing with fallback. You can kind of like have some noisy operations that I'm told can get you down to even 50.
And you chose the 10 to the minus 16. Is that double precision?
I mean, this is somebody. I think somebody told me these numbers. I won't throw them under the biggest wrong, but I don't want to call them out. But so somebody I trust ran the numbers and said that this is the numbers that they got back. I'll just put it that way.
And that RZ is supposed to be generic.
Yeah, it's just what he ran when he checked it.
I mean, it's a gate that appears in Schwarz algorithm.
Yes. Nice.
Yeah, if you do a Fourier transform, you really want to do a two pi over two to the n. So you really need these very small, tiny phases.
It's a little off the main topic, but you mentioned a couple of times in relation to this paradoxical decomposition of the sphere.
Yeah.
And you said it was explicit, but I always thought it can't possibly be explicit because it involves some sort of non-measurable sets, and you can never explicitly sort of meta theorem.
What you describe is a set of rotations explicitly, and then from that you infer the existence of this paradoxical decomposition. So
I see.
I think that the original I'm not sure, but I feel like the original proof of the existence of like a two-generator free group in SO3 was not done explicitly. I'm not sure. I mean, Banach proved this, I think, in the paper where he gave the Banach-Tarski paradox. And I think what it has to do, there's this question of like invariant means So a measure is a countably additive function that's positive. A mean is something that's finitely additive. And then there was a question of if you have an invariant mean, is it necessarily proportional to the uniform measure? And so Banach, in the same paper where he showed the Banach-Tarski paradox, he showed that for the one sphere, this is not the case. So you can have many different invariant means that are different from the uniform measure. But it was an open question to show this for like the two sphere and three sphere. I think it was proved for the four sphere and higher that actually any invariant mean was proportional to the Bayes measure for like in like the early 80s.
Invariant means under all rotations?
Just under the yeah. And then there was a kind of a very hard proof that relied on some heavy results from number theory given by Drinfeld for the two and three sphere. They call this the Ruchowitz problem. And then Lubatsky Phillips Tarnik gave a very explicit construction of this free subgroup of SO3. That they were able to then somehow turn into an explicit proof. And I'm not fully comfortable with all the details there, but I think it's that distinction.
So I think the proof for Banach-Karski uses sometimes the axiom of choice or something like that. Mm-hmm. Do your techniques somehow change that or make it less non-constructive?
I think you still need axiom of choice. So I think you have to choose. I think that's where the paradox really comes from. But maybe it's, I think, given a free group inside SO3, I think then you apply axiom of choice to get the paradoxical decomposition. But I think the question is, how do you get that free group? And maybe Banach proved that a random two-generator subgroup is free. I don't know how he proved it. But I think maybe that might be what it was. Maybe he just should pick two. That's how I would try to do it first. Just pick two random rotations. Probably with probability one, they form a free group. But this is an explicit construction.
Kind of the first step is more explicit.
Yeah.
But the second step where you use the axiom of choice. Well,
yeah, I think you would need something like axiom of choice to get
you would, I think, because
something weird like that to happen.
It's claimed that if you drop the axiom of choice, you can add the axiom that every set is a vague measure.
Mm-hmm.
And then this wouldn't happen.
Okay.
Okay.
Well, thanks.
Thank you.